Welcome to East Meets West, episode 167. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Roger Chang.
And we are freshly returned from Comic-Con. Both of
yes,
us.
Yes. Fresh is probably not the word. More like tired.
Stinkily returned from Comic-Con?
Fatigued? Veterans?
I was only this is my first time of Comic-Con, so I definitely can't claim the title of veteran. And I was only there Friday evening and then Saturday and part of Sunday. So I didn't get as tired out as you probably did.
It's just walking the floor, talking to people, just so many things that are going on. You kind of get your senses get, you know, maxed out all the time.
Although I have to say, having been to E3 and CES a bunch, Comic-Con is much more reserved in a way than those. It's not everywhere you go at CES and especially E3. It's blinking lights and loud music and blam blam blam. Comic-Con's not like that. There's a few booths with some, you know, loud noises going on, but it's a lot more sedate in that flashiness sort of way.
I think part of it is because there are restrictions on noise and stuff you can do from your booth. Whereas E3 this year was pretty reserved too.
Was it?
I think it's partially because, you know, people are kind of tired of having, you know, multi-megawatt, you know, 100-megawatt sound systems blowing in from the booth across the aisle. And then you're trying to work or do business and you can't, you know, hear yourself and you're screaming at the other person. It's like being in a bar, like a really crowded bar where you're constantly, you know, screaming to be heard. Comic-Con's not like that, and it's also not an industry show. It's put on by fans, and it has always been put on by fans. And it definitely shows because it is a nonprofit, and the motive there is to kind of keep the community engaged with, you know, the various movies, television shows, comic books, a lot of the pop culture that has now kind of permeated the convention.
I liked that about Comic-Con. I liked the fact that you could just go in and walk up to a booth and someone is selling comics, you know, collectible comics, modern comics, indie comics. I mean, there are a ton of authors. I walked up in the sort of the authors area, and Brian Herbert and Kevin Anderson, who write the Dune extended universe novels, sort of prequels and sequels, were there, manning their booth with a bunch of their books, you know, trying to sell books. It was fantastic.
Yeah, and it's kind of weird because people think of comic conventions in very narrow terms, like, you know, it's like geeky guys that, you know, talk about like Spider-Man, Superman, you know, and maybe play with action figures and video games. All those things are present, but I mean, that entire audience is so much more. I mean, you got people who are there for, you know, the gothic, you know, vampire style, you know, fantasy stuff. You got,
you know what? It was mostly normal people. And when I say normal, like people, if you didn't know it was Comic-Con and you looked around, I'd say, what do you think? 20% of people dressed up in costume. Which is unusual for a conference. You usually see people dressed up in costume. But yeah, there were elves and superheroes and robots running around. But the rest of the people, they just look like people that would be at any county fair or, you know, concert down by the lake. I mean, it's not a bunch of like really strange people. It's a small amount of really strange people.
Well, they're not even really strange because, well, first of all,
strange,
the costumes.
Strange, I don't mean strange as an insult at all. I mean strange as in, like, you wouldn't expect to see someone like that normally. Somebody dressed up as Darth Vader walking around. That's strange. But it's not strange at Comic-Con. It's perfectly appropriate and normal and way cool.
Well, that's my thing. It's like, I think it's perfectly normal. And I think everyone there has their own inner kind of like, oh, wish I could do that. Like, you know, whether it be the costumes or kind of the fandom, there are a lot of people who seem, you know, like they're the kind of, you know, the average, you know, John and Jane Doe, you know, that make up, you know, society, and they seem to be pretty plain.
Families,
but everyone has
families, people with like two kids, people with kids in strollers, you know, I mean, they were there too. They weren't the majority, but that's what I mean is, like, I don't think it's ever expressed appropriately the diversity of people that go to Comic-Con. It's all thought of in stereotypes. And so even when you were trying to say, like, oh, it's not just the comic book nerds, it's the goths. It's like, I can already hear somebody going, yeah, it's just a bunch of really far out people on the fringe. It's not. It's them and mainstream people and conservative people. I mean,
it's weird because the people dress up also cut like an amazing, you know, diversity from the left, left of field to the right of field, and, you know, any which way in terms of, you know, economic tax bracket. Because people just – it's an excuse to kind of let loose, kind of the same way Halloween. You know, people get to kind of, you know, release themselves from that kind of social, you know, etiquette that people are so consciously, you know, well, you can't do that because, you know, they might not understand it. I mean, Eileen went to some of the panels, and you can see when you sit in the audience, and she was saying this to me in the morning, it's like, it's actually really nice to hear other people, you know, say the same things when they see a scene, ask the same questions you've always wanted to ask. And it's not like just, you know, people that like, that would seem to be the demographic.
You're just hanging around with other fans, and that's what unites you.
Yeah, and I think that's really what it is. Comic-Con is just like this big celebration of fandom, whether you're a hardcore Star Trek or whether you enjoy all science fiction or you just like, you know, Lost or you like True Blood, you like Twilight, you like those elements of popular culture that you see and you're really into it. You like know the actors' names, you know who directs it, you know, stuff that I think, you know, people usually mark as being geeky, and it kind of, I think, illustrates the fact that everyone has a certain amount of geekdom in them.
I think what you said earlier is really important too, about the fact that this was a non-profit and it's put on by fans, because you can really feel that it's huge and mm-hmm. there's a lot of rules and a lot of organization that has to happen when you have something that big, but at the same time it's not impersonal and the rules are not there without any regard to what people want. They're kind of put in place kind of only to the point that is necessary. So when they're saying, well, the doors are closed until 9 a.m., but there's a panel inside that you want to line up for, they let you in to go to that panel before 9 a.m. They don't just say bureaucratically, nope, doors don't open until 9, not our problem, because they understand. They're like, okay, yeah, if you're going to that panel, of course you can go in, go up those stairs. That's where you get to.
And most of those rules are there for safety.
Yeah.
Because especially when you're dealing with 100,000+ people, I mean, this is funny. I was we were at the Buzz Out Loud meetup, and Brendan, who was there, is a volunteer for the Comic-Con, San Diego Comic-Con, the WonderCon, up here in San Francisco.
And congratulations and he was saying, to Brendan on his new daughter.
Yes, congratulations. And he was saying to me, like, the president of Comic-Con got, like, run over by a bunch of fans who were trying to get a Green Lantern autograph session with the writers and illustrators. And, you know, the guy says, like, look, you know, we can't have this happen. We can't have people, you know, in a position where they're going to be, you know, injured because, you know, there's an onslaught of really eager people who might not be thinking, you know, it's not that they're malevolent or they're selfish. It's just that it doesn't occur to them when they're all kind of like, oh my God, I need to get that signature.
Get caught up
I need
in the moment.
Need to talk about. So, you know, a lot of those reasons. So people don't get injured, people don't get hurt, and also a sense of fairness. So like, you know, some people might argue, why don't they clear out the rooms, you know, between panels? Because these panels are, although they sit six.
Yeah, we should point out to anybody who doesn't know, Comic-Con sort of in two very broad strokes, and this is extremely broad, is sort of a show floor and then a panels area. And there's other things going on too, but that's kind of your two main things going on. And the panels are in separate halls, and you line up ahead of time, and you go in, and the panels are essentially TV shows or sometimes comic books or just talks or screenings, and it's first come, first serve.
And, you know, for the more popular ones, I mean, you know, Eileen could testify. She got up. What time did she get up? 7 o'clock?
She got up at 6 and headed out at 7, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just like, you know, there's that amount of dedication. It's like people lining up to see Star Wars, like, for the first time, like, you know, before people realized how crappy the Phantom Menace was. They, you know, they camped out, you know, months ahead, where you have that kind of dedication. You kind of have that.
Well, and what you were saying was, to make it fair, they don't clear out the room between panels. So, you know, if the Twilight panel is happening after the Fringe panel or the American Dad panel, and you want to make sure you're going to be in the Twilight panel, you might have to go and sit through those other panels, which some people criticize. But at the same time, if you didn't, if you had to clear it out, then anybody who wanted to see two panels back to back would have to go back and get in line. And these lines are literally thousands of people long.
And that's one of those things where you can honestly say Comic-Con's a bit of a victim of its own success. It's grown year after year. In fact, you know, currently there were talks or at least rumors that they were going to move it because the convention center right now is literally at the seams of the number of people that can be accommodated. The tickets sold out in 2 months when they were when they went on sale, like in early spring.
But
that never happened before.
there's a couple of things that I would contrast it with to show that sort of fan-centric nature that they're struggling with given the size of it. One is, in that situation where the president of Comic-Con got run over by the Green Lantern fans and said, hey, you know what, we've got to make this safe. The reaction, if it were, let's say, a trade association, would have been to clamp down and really restrict things and push people away and sort of even dissuade people a little bit from going to panels, you know? But because it's fan-oriented, they didn't do that. They did just what they think they need to do to make it safe. Wrap around lines, make it clear where to line up, get a lot of folks volunteering along those lines to help keep order and explain what's going on. They didn't cut panels, which you might have expected them to do. The other thing I would contrast it with is South by Southwest, where what they did in especially in the music area, was they started tiering it. So it used to be open to everybody, and then they got too many crowds. So they started selling wristbands, and you had to have a wristband to get into the official shows. Then that started getting too crowded. So they started selling tiers of wristbands, and then the VIPs started coming. So the VIPs got wristbands and got let in first before the people who had even paid for wristbands. And even if you paid for a wristband, you weren't guaranteed. And then the record companies started showing up, and so then they had lists, and so then you had several tiers of VIP bands that would get you in, or passes that would get you in, and the wristband people were sometimes complaining, even if you buy a wristband, you still had to go and get in line early and all this stuff. So there was some negative emotion around there because it's like, well, this isn't about the fans anymore. And I really don't feel that at Comic-Con. It's sort of like, you know what, the die-hardest fans win in those panel situations, because they get there early, they wait in line, they dress up, they're ready, and they do what it takes to get in there. And Eileen and Lynn, both, you keep mentioning Eileen, but don't forget Lynn was along with her. They're the two that do Bite Club. They went and they did it upright, and they made sure they got in that True Blood panel, and they had to sit through several others. They made sure they got in that Lost panel. They had to sit through several others, but they did what was needed to get in and make sure they saw the panels they wanted to see. It's unfortunate that you have to be that dedicated, though.
Yeah, and you know, in a perfect world, everyone would get in. It's so popular, just like so many people. And with the addition of the studios and the broadcast networks, like CBS and NBC, like, you know, ABC showing off their, you know, fall lineup and season, getting people excited about it. It's a weird kind of love-hate relationship. On one hand, you hate it for all the things they bring to the convention that you generally don't like the marketing and the endless number of PR people, but you love it because they're bringing the stuff that you want to see, that you want to hear from the people, you want to hear from the stars, hear from the producers, the directors, you know, what they got in the works. And it's almost a symbiotic relationship. The studios, the producers, the actors, they're talking to the people that are eager, willing consumers of their content. They're the people that are going to shape the opinion of a movie, of a TV series, of a group of TV series, and they're going to tell their friends. So, you know, it's like, you know, hey, these eager people want to listen to us. We're going to tell them. You know, it might get a little kind of frictiony at some point when you get so many people jammed in the room, but overall, I'm very impressed at how well everything works.
Yeah, and I have to say, those panels, at least in my little experience of watching videos and attending the Doctor Who panel on Sunday, are set up for the fans. Even though they're set up by the studios, they really do cater to the fans. They understand who they're talking to, and they're not trying to pull a marketing job, and they're not trying to hoodwink people. And it's a half hour of talk, usually, and then a half hour of questions from the audience. And it's really questions from the audience. It's not a bunch of press people up there that get to go first. You know, it's the guy dressed up as Data asking David Tennant a question. You know what I mean? Like,
it's and that stuff just totally blows my mind, because when they started doing that, you know, I was kind of unsure when San Diego actually started branching out into that. I mean, for those not in the know, San Diego Comic-Con actually started very small in the 70s, and it was just, you know, a comic book collector trading thing, and they started inviting artists, you know, publishers like Marvel and DC, but it was still kind of, you know, a comic book centric thing. They kind of knew that they wanted to expand out. They started including sci-fi merchandising, so, you know, Star Wars or Star Trek, but still pretty kind of in that geeky vein. Over the last 5-6 years, you kind of see where the studios kind of the light bulb went on over their head and say, oh my God, there's this convention where all these people do nothing but want to watch our content. Why don't we do something for them, get them excited about it so they can get their friends, their families excited about it, and, you know, kind of be the foot soldiers, so to speak, of spreading their particular, you know, message or kind of vision they have for their particular properties.
I would say it's almost branching out into being NerdCon or GeekCon rather than, you know, it's gone beyond comics for sure,
yeah.
And it's gone into any of the content that is treated in the world of comics, but with a focus on that sci-fi and fantasy realm that kind of dribbles out into things like Fringe or Lost that aren't classic sci-fi fantasy, but they definitely have that comic book edge, that
Lost
fantasy edge, yeah.
And, you know, for most people, it's actually just a pop culture, you know, it should be kind of be fandom con, really.
Yeah,
but it is a celebration of pop culture in its truest kind of, I think, most sincere form. You know, you don't have. I mean, you do have people marketing to you. You do have sellers trying to sell you stuff. But
marketing isn't bad if you want it.
Well, yes.
The reason we all criticize marketing is when they lie or they try to market something to us that we don't want. And that happens a lot. It's wastage. It's the breakage of PR. But if they're marketing, like you and I, we went to the Doctor Who panel and they marketed to us. They showed us the trailer for Planet of the Dead, which we'd both seen. But it was coming out on BBC America that afternoon. They showed us a trailer for the upcoming Doctor Who episodes later this year, and they showed us a trailer of the final episode where we say goodbye to David Tennant. That's all marketing, but we totally want that because we're interested in it. You know what I mean? So
exactly.
And a level of unwanted marketing at Comic-Con exists, but I feel like it's fairly low relative to most other trade shows that I've been to.
And I actually appreciate the member, like my friends, George and Alien over at October Toys. They have a small business where they create and manufacture and sell vinyl collectible toys.
Yeah,
and
it doesn't do it justice. They manufacture a bunch of cool stuff. And it's toys, and they're really awesome. And you have not done them justice explaining them to me how cool it was when I walked up to their booth and I saw little plastic zombies for sale in little bags, and this like amazingly done realistic zombie standing in front of their toy shop. Really, really cool stuff.
And you got, you know, a ton of them. You got a ton of those types of businesses. It isn't just like a huge Walmart, you buy this from here, and, you know, a Target, you know,
single
booth or anything.
Supplier, yeah.
It's this, you know, kind of niche group of people who sell all these things. I mean, granted, the guys who do the t-shirts are kind of one of the bigger store guys there, but, you know, you got, you know, independent comic book stores. You got the comic book stores that only operate online, but they come to the convention to sell their overflow. You know, they do the 50% off cover price trades and graphic novels. You got the guys who sell you, like, you know, collectible toys that you can't get unless you buy it, you know, from some website or you go to Japan, you know, for those super ultra rare items. You get t-shirts, you get, you know, you get like face painting, you get art, custom art, like people would draw you, you know, oh, I want a dragon, draw your dragon, you know, sign it, and you're happy. I'm just consistently amazed at the number of people who can come together and do something. And while, yeah, it is commercial, it doesn't feel that way. It doesn't feel the dirty part of when you say it's
not
commercial.
It's not crass. There's nothing wrong with being commercial. I think it gets a bad name because of people who, again, are trying to sell you something you don't need, or lying to you and selling you something that they say is one thing and turns out to be another, or just not very good. Jonathan Colton, the independent musician, is commercial. He wants to sell you things. He wants to make money. He wants to only do that for a living. There's nothing wrong with being commercial. But he also doesn't come out and lie to you and try to hoodwink you and rip you off and put DRM on his stuff and sell you things you don't need. You know, so that there's a line there. A lot of people cross that line. Even at Comic-Con, there's plenty of people crossing that line. But like you say, there's a lot of really good, honest people who are doing it for the passion of the content or the toys that they make or the drawings that they make. And that's really cool to see.
Now, did you see anything in particular that stood out to you that, like, oh my God, that is so cool, I would have never imagined that?
I would have never imagined that.
Like you wouldn't not imagine, but maybe didn't expect that. Like, was it a costume? Was it a group of people? Was it like some sort of booth setup? Was it like the panels?
I actually already told you the thing I would have never imagined, which is just like your regular old mom, dad, and two kids in the numbers that I saw just chugging around. I expected the weird stuff. I expected the outlandish stuff. I didn't expect the amount of non-weird stuff. Or people in that case, really. I didn't expect the number of small vendors that I saw, like who were just doing their comic books or illustrations. Like, you know, they haven't pushed out the fact that this is a comic book show. Sure, I know people who are old school and been going to Comic-Con since the 70s are going to be like, oh, there's hardly any of that left. But there is some of it left, and I honestly didn't even expect that. And so I found that to be really cool, especially the nostalgia stuff, the really old comic books. Really love that stuff. We should try to talk about the Doctor Who panel.
The Doctor Who panel was great. Now, for those who weren't there or can only catch photos or maybe little home videos of it, I was really impressed with not only Russell Davies, but Dave Tennant, the director, the woman in charge. Oh, I should remember her name.
Julie Gardner.
You know how open, sincere, especially when there are answering those questions from the audience. And, you know, some of those questions can be kind of, you know, direct. And not in the kind of crude sense, but people like, okay, so what's the deal? Is this person alive? Is this person dead? You know, are you going to do something after, you know, you're finished with Doctor Who? Are you going to do a musical? Or are you going to do this? And then you weren't there for the Torchwood panel, but a woman came up and asked a question that was very critical of one of the plot decisions they made and wanted to know why they made it in that way. And, you know, it's kind of cool because it's a conversation. It's producers talking to their audience and the audience talking back. Normally when you yell at the TV, you don't hear anything.
Yeah, right. And it was funny. In the Doctor Who panel, there was one Torchwood question, and that was the only time that they seemed to get a little ruffled and say, yeah, there's a Torchwood panel later on this afternoon if you want to ask Torchwood questions. This is about Doctor Who. But most of the time, they were happy to try. Although David Tennant often went to, I can't really choose, because there were a lot of those, what is your favorite Doctor? What is your favorite episode? And he's like, please don't put me on the spot. I'm gonna really incense someone who is a colleague of mine if you make me pick, you know. So there were a lot of those kind of questions that didn't get answered.
But I think that's kind of cool, though. Like, you know, kind of, you know, it's not insensitive when it's like, you know, would you do that to your wife or anything or anything of a personal nature, but really kind of their role with the franchise, with that character, and kind of understanding everything a little bit better. And it's really cool because, you know, again, I mean, when you yell at your TV, it doesn't yell back. People talk, well, you get director's commentaries. That's great. You might have other questions. It's like having
a lot of times those director's commentaries end up being a long chat between
whoever's
on it, which is okay in some ways. It's like a listening to a podcast, but you almost don't need the episode playing or the movie playing at that point because you're not even talking about what's going on.
You know what the funniest one I've ever heard? Just a side note from a DVD director's commentary was Resident Evil. I think it was the first, no, the second one. So they had the director and they had Mila Jovovich in it, and she was eating a sandwich during the recording of the. So you could hear her in between, you know, the conversation. I thought it was the funniest. You know what?
Somebody out there right now is like, I'd listen to Mila eat a sandwich. I don't care. Well, I don't know.
But
we should mention it was Eros Lin. I don't know how you pronounce his first name, actually. It's E-U-R-O-S.
That's it.
The director was the other member of the panel. He didn't get many questions. He barely talked.
I think he's partially because, you know, Russell Davies comes up with the content, and of course David Tennant is the, you know, the protagonist, the hero.
He's the Time Lord.
Yeah, I guess if you were a director, I guess there would be more there would have to be more kind of movie buffs who want to know, like, what kind of moves did you do? How did you do the special effects?
And this is the old crew. All of these folks are leaving when the new executive producer and the new doctor start in the next season. This is David Tennant's last. It's not even a full season. It's like a 5-episode arc. And Russell T. Davies is moving on. He will no longer be the writer and executive producer. Julie Gardner is moving on. I assume Eros Lin could be brought back as a director. It depends, because directors change more often. But so a lot of these questions about what's the future, what's going to happen, they had to say, like, we don't know. It's out of our hands. Like, we know what these last couple episodes are going to be like, and we'll give you some hints about that. But after that, all bets are off. So we definitely are going to be brought to tears in the final episode, they said. They said they were bawling while they were shooting it. So I don't know if they're building it up too much, but it sounds like it's going to be a pretty dramatic final episode where we say goodbye to David Tennant and meet the new doctor.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how that turns out. I mean, Dave Tennant brought up a very good point. He said, "I used to think that, you know, Tom Baker was the doctor, you know, and he would always be the doctor. He was the best doctor." And then, you know, after he moved on, and his particular iteration of the doctor passed away, and we got John Davidson. It's like, 3 weeks later, okay, that's the new doctor. He's the best doctor. He is the doctor, and it's just. You know, it's one of those things. You know, you're really attached to something, but, you know, sometimes you'll like what comes out of it, the new change. That said, I think what they're planning, or at least from the snippets we've seen, I'm really excited. So hopefully it doesn't disappoint.
Can you give any hints from those snippets that you remember?
I don't know.
Because I have to say, while you're thinking about that, I really liked Chris Eccleston as the doctor. I thought he was amazing. It really revived my interest in the whole series. And when they got rid of him after the first season, I was like, well, this is dumb. And then they brought in this cute guy. He's a Scottish guy, and he's trying to talk with an English accent, and he's kind of a fop. And, like, Eccleston looked like an alien, and this guy just looks like, you know, pretty boy. I was not impressed at all. And it has turned out that I like David Tennant the best of all of them. And that's no disrespect to Chris Eccleston, but I just, the way he did that role just enraptured me. So, you know, like you say, I may be skeptical of this new doctor at first, but it's always a different role every time they replace him.
Yeah, I think, was it Water of Mars? I think was that one of them?
That's
that
the second to last one, right? That's the next one we're going to see in November, I think.
The Water of Mars one looks more like a horror based, kind of in the same venue as what was the one where doctor Martha Washington weren't really in it.
Martha,
he was just
Jones,
in the DVD.
Not Martha Washington. Martha Washington was the first lady.
Well, who am I thinking of?
Martha Jones.
Oh, Martha Jones. My bad. I'm such a bad fan.
No. The one where they're trapped in the
Blink. Was it Blink or something? Was that
Blink
the name?
Blink is the one with the statues.
No. But it's kind of like that. It's kind of like it looks very.
You know what? You're right. It has elements of Blink because of the horror. But it also reminded me of the one where they are in the space station on the edge of the black hole.
The space station or the planet? Oh yeah, the space station, and then there was
Ship. I guess it's a ship, not a space station. But yeah,
and Satan's in the planet below. Right. Yeah, that one, the Satan pit.
Yeah.
So that those two episodes, so it has that feeling. So, you know, I'm really excited because I really loved Blink because that was, I thought, one of the best episodes that featured Dave Tenth.
And if you're a fan of the library, Russell T. Davies let drop that there might be some return of River Song at some point, which is the future companion that we met in the library. Now, he didn't say for sure, he didn't confirm anything, but he hinted around very heavily.
Yeah, and those, again, that was, you know, that's my another top favorite episode, The Library. I thought that was a brilliant plot, extremely well scripted. And, you know, I'm really hoping that this, at least with Dave Tennant, it really ends on a really kind of, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, uplifting, but it just has to be good.
Yeah, absolutely agree. All right, folks. Well, we didn't talk about politics and we didn't talk about hot dogs. But if you go to sobrilliant.com/EMW, I was worried that people weren't going to get into the soda and junk food and donuts.
People love food.
People are all over it. They're talking about their favorites. They're talking about Timmy Ho's. We learned like the entire history of the Timmy's coffee, the Tim Horton coffee. It was Dave Broadbeck says the guy who founded the shop was a Toronto Maple Leaf defenseman in the 70s. Who knew? So and that they are like the Dunkin' Donuts of Canada. A lot more talk about sodas and regional foods.
And then, you know, you learned things like, you know, you don't have Hardee's or Carl's Jr. Actually, I've noticed that there was a lot of chains that don't exist.
Yeah, it was interesting.
Houston, Manhattan.
Who was writing about Roy Rogers being bought by Hardee's and then turned back? It was Reed, the ISP infrastructure guy, tells the story about Roy Rogers being bought by Hardee's, and then they failed at it, and a bunch of the Roy Rogers franchises rebought the name and have been trying to rebuild the chain from scratch. So I thought that was pretty interesting, too. So check it out, sobrilliant.com/EMW, and if you have questions or comments about your own thoughts on Comic-Con or Doctor Who, comment on this episode.
Bye.
Bye.